All right, without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Kevin G.
Kevin, alcoholic. Hi. I brought this up here. I don't know if I'm going to read out of it, but it makes it look like I might know what I'm talking about.
Sorry.
So, my sobriety date is January 23rd, 2012. My home group is the Thursday Night Men's Stag Group, and my sponsor is Luke V. So, if I make it, like 9 more days, I'll have 12 years of sobriety by the grace of God and this fellowship, you know. And, you know, thanks, Robert, for being just a little bit nervous when you read the when you did that, I just went, I'm with my people, you know what I mean? I'm amongst my family, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just reminded me of that, you know, because my ego wants to tell me, you know, oh, this has to be a great teaching moment, man. This is gonna be like the Sermon on the Mount, you know. You know, and then I, you know, and reason and recovery tells me, calm down, Goofy. It's you at the 1600 Club, all right? And just share your experience, strength, and hope, and ask God to get you out of the way, and hopefully He'll speak through you. And tonight I'm just doing a little something different, you know. I didn't have anything planned, and I'm not going to go in chronological order of my life like I normally do, you know. Just going to let it flow, and whatever comes out, you know. And welcome to the newcomers. Welcome home. Who was the other guy? All right, welcome, brother. Welcome home, you know. I hope you hear something here tonight, or you find what I've found in this program, a life beyond my wildest dreams, you know. I mean, there's a guy that calls me every year on my birthday from Orange County. His name's Rob H. And he calls me up, and he says, hey, I heard you're having a birthday today. Tell me what you were doing 12 years ago yesterday, the day before your sobriety date. You know, just think about that. If you've been around a while, think about what were you doing the day before you got sober, you know, and then compare your life to what your life is today, if you've been around a while, you know. A lot of us, that was a pretty dark day, you know what I mean? And what I have today compared to that day is just amazing, and I'm so grateful for it. You know, I mean, the book tells us that we're a group that wouldn't normally mix, right? I mean, you look around the room and look at all the people, you know. And I always like to do this and just say, can you just imagine if we were all on one right now? I mean, if everyone in this room was loaded right now, what it would be like? You know what I mean? There, you know, you got some people over here crying, there'd be people over here fighting, you know, it'd be, oh, yeah, Glenda would be crying, I'd probably be crying, you know. You'd have people passed out, people wet themselves, girls would be sitting on guys' laps asking to buy them a drink. The room would probably be on fire, the building would probably be on fire. You know, an alcoholic like me, I'd be like, this looks like a perfect time to get naked. You know, I'd start running around the room, you know. I wish I had a cool story like the guy that lived in a treehouse and sold meth out of his mom and dad's front yard, and the cops raided the treehouse and stuff, but that's not me, you know. That's not my story. Just to let you know, I'm just going to go into this real quickly because I don't want to stand up here and cry for 45 minutes. I'll just let you know where I came from and just touch on my childhood real quick. You know, I grew up in foster care, you know, and in foster care, you know, I suffered a lot of abuse and sexual abuse and mental abuse. And, you know, it was rough, man. It was rough. It's, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, when you're a kid, you don't have tools to deal with that kind of stuff. You know, you deal with it. You learn how to cope in whatever way you learn how to cope, you know. And I don't know my father. I never met the man. He left when I was 2. My mom was schizophrenic, and back then they would just dose him with meds. And she was institutionalized, so that's why my little brother and I had to go into foster care, you know. And you know, it's one thing when it's happened to you, but then when you have to watch it happen to your little brother and you're helpless and you can't do anything about it, it's hard. And yeah, there's still pain there, but I'm an emotional guy, just to let you guys know. I cry over Disney movies. I mean, we were watching a movie one time. My girlfriend looks over at me, "Are you crying?" I'm all, "Nope." She's all, "Babe, we're watching Joe Dirt." But I cried at the end, you know. His parents didn't want him and stuff, and I could relate, you know. But you know, as a kid, it was bittersweet. I mean, I definitely didn't come from, you know, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, you know. And I had it rough coming up. And you know, they would bring my mom out to the foster home like once every 6 months to see us kids, you know. And all those feelings that I stuffed down and built up walls around me, those walls would just come crumbling down, you know, and I had to open those wounds again, you know, and it was just like this cycle that kept happening every 6 months, you know. So I learned at a very young age that with pain and stuff like that, you just stuff it down. You just stuff it down, you know, and you don't look at it. And I carried that into my adult life, you know what I mean? And I never got treatment or help for it. That, you know, when I did the steps, you know, that was my part in that. That was my part. I never took the action to get the help I needed. I turned to King Alcohol is what I did. That was my medicine, right, in that situation. You know? And pretty much every situation, you know. Let's be real when it comes down to it, you know. We lived out in the country. So it was kind of cool being a kid out in the country, cruising around on our bikes, fishing poles, just running around, you know, working on the farm, doing all that stuff. You know, I got into music really young. I was in a little band with my best friends. We rehearsed in a hayloft in a barn up above a horse. It was pretty funny. And we had dreams of being rock stars. You know, I wanted to be a rock star my whole life. You know, and came pretty dang close too, you know, when I got older. But you know, we had let's see, Sal, where was I at? I told him before the meeting I'm gonna lose my train of thought. You're gonna tell me, man, I was gonna be a rock star, right? No, but I was talking about how bittersweet it was, right? You know, there was cool being out in the country. It was cool playing the band with my friends. It was kind of cool. So it wasn't all bad, you know, but the bad stuff I didn't know how to heal from, right? And I got a girlfriend in like junior high, and she became like my everything, like my higher power, you know, because you know I was always comparing my insides to your outsides, like we hear in the program. You know, I would look at other kids, my friends, and they would have families. They would have a mom and a dad, you know, and I didn't know what that felt like, you know, to have like a biological mother and father that just gave you this unconditional love and that held you and loved you. I was super, you know, envious of that. You know, I wanted that. I always wanted what you had, you know, and you always had better than I had in my perception. You know what I mean? So I had these thoughts and feelings instilled in me from a young age of not being good enough. You know what I mean? I'm not a real son. I'm just a foster kid. You know, they had their own kids, you know, too, as well, that were just a little bit older than me. And we had some older foster brothers as well, too. So I had these types of things that we hear about in the rooms, you know, really instilled in me as a child, you know. And as I got older, you know, of course, I carried that stuff with me, you know. And I remember being around, somewhere between 12 and 14 where I just snapped. And, you know, no one was going to touch me like that again. No one was going to abuse me again. And I just started fighting. And I started fighting back. I remember fighting back, you know, family members in that home. And I started fighting at school. I just started fighting. I wasn't going to let anybody disrespect me, you know. And that's another thing, you know, another resentment or another emotion that I had no coping skills. It's just going in the wrong freaking direction, you know. And so I get my high school sweetheart, right? And I cling to her like she's my everything, you know, because I don't really have a family. And I just, like, she was everything to me, you know. And then when I turned 16, I left the foster home. I bounced. I just left. And I went to her farm. And her family took me in. And I lived on the farm, you know. I was milking cows every morning before I went to high school. My girlfriend knows, you're not going to say it. I was milking the cows and the farmer's daughter. She's heard me talk like too many times. But it was the truth. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I was like 16. She was like 14. And I was like living there with them. But I was doing all the work on the farm and doing this and that. And, you know, when I became 18. Glenn, you've never heard that before. When I turned 18, I wasn't going to go to college. That wasn't even an afterthought, you know. It was either I was going to stay, work on the farm, or I was going to go in the military. So I went in the military, and I married her, and we got married, and we moved back east, you know, and I did, you know, I did well in the military. I did good. I got in a fight early on and got in a little bit of trouble. Got some NJP, you know, right off the bat, and it kept me from doing some things that I wanted to do. And then I started getting into martial arts, really a lot in the military. And I was training to be on the Navy Taekwondo team, and I was really super serious about this, you know. And throughout my life, it was a pattern, kind of like martial arts, and then music, martial arts, music, and I kept flip-flopping back and forth. And martial arts was always really good for me. It was a healthy thing. There was good tenets to live by, meditation and family and all the kids. And I was teaching all these kids. It was a good thing. And music was ego and sex and drugs and rock and roll, you know. That's what the music was. And I just kept flip-flopping for like a couple of years here, a couple of years there, you know. It was crazy. And I couldn't figure out, why can't I just stick to some one thing, you know. But anyway, towards the end of my military career, my wife at the time just comes home one night and just totally unbeknownst to me, I had no clue, man. She just said, I don't love you anymore, packed the bag, and was gone in 15 minutes. And she had been cheating on with me with another man and just bounced and went to Mexico with him. And that was just like, that, like, man, I went on a 2-year pity party on that one. I just drank and drank and drank and just really just slept with woman after woman after, you know, trying to fix an inside problem with outside things like we talk about in here all the time, you know. And I just did that. And it was just poor me, poor me, poor me. And I had this mentality that, you know, why are they doing this to me? Why is this happening to me? Why does this always happen to me, you know? Why me, poor me, you know? Pour me another drink is what it turned into, you know? You know, so, yeah. So it got, you know, so then I, you know, I started getting the great idea that, you know, I'd start pulling geographics and that would fix things, you know? I was down in San Diego when she left me. My bro came and got me, brought me up to Northern California. And me and him just partied and just crazy, crazy stuff. And, you know, and I burned it down up there. And I thought, I got to get out of here. This place is crazy. I can't handle it. You know, I'm doing all this crazy stuff. And I moved back down to Southern California. And I met my cousin, who was a cocaine dealer, said, you need to come down here and be with family and be with me. It's my real cousin, my biological cousin. And I move in with him, and that was a really bad idea. You know, I've never seen so much cocaine in my life, you know. I mean, there would be parties with just pile, like a big old pile like that on a table, and it's all these weird people. And it was just, it was crazy, man, you know. And I remember nights of just being just so, like, twacked out, man. I mean, you just smoke like 50 cigarettes, drink like 60 beers, and you're just doing cocaine all night. You're like, you know, you're all distorted, and you got little arms like a Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know. You're doing all this weird shit with your mouth, you know, and you get, You know, and I remember waking up, or not waking up. What am I talking about? I never went to bed. I remember being in the morning times. You'd come out and the sun's up. You're like, oh shit, the sun's up. You know, and I'd see the normal people like waking up, going to work. You know, and I was like, wow, that just tripped me out. And that feeling, you know, my sponsor calls it the cocaine blues. You know, you have that remorse and that feeling, and next thing you know, you're in your bathroom, looking in the mirror, crying. You don't even know why you're crying. You don't know why you're up. You're all twacked out. And, you know, it was just horrible, man. And all the crazy stuff we do on that, you know. And, you know, but it always, always, always started with alcohol. Always, you know, with me. I mean, I remember, you know, I talk about, like, what it was like, okay? You know, what it was like. It sucked. It was total helplessness, you know? I God wasn't my higher power. Alcohol was my higher power. You know what I mean? I wasn't a tough guy. I thought I was a tough guy. I wasn't a tough guy. I was a big baby. Every time I had a problem, I cried to my bottle. You know what I mean? I would go to the bar. I had this buddy named Howard. Brooks, he knows Howard. So does Nate. He's totally crazy. We've been in so much. I don't even know how both of us are alive today. You know, we've had guns in our faces. We've had just all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, we're running around toting guns, thinking we were some kind of tough guy. You know, and it's just amazing we lived through all that. And we would go to the bar, and he didn't drink like me. He was way crazier than me. He's got psychological problems. You know, sorry, Howard. If he hears this recording, but he's just straight crazy, you know, and he would do a lot of drugs and this and that, but he would look at me like, dude, you know, like, you're out of control with your drinking. He would look at me, you know, and I would think, man, you're looking at me like that? You're nuts, bro. You know, and I would tell him things like, bro, okay, I'm going to have a shot of whiskey. So now you got to stop me, because I'm not going to stop. I knew I wasn't going to stop. Once I had that first shot, I was done, man. And I would say, after about six shots, pull me out of here. You know, and he'd be like, no, dude, don't do it. Just don't do it, bro. And I'd be all, nah, it's time for a shot. You know what I mean? And what was really like, you know, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful, right? I mean, you know, I could go sometimes and just have a beer. I might be able to go have a glass of wine sometimes, you know, but as soon as that, I just never know what's going to happen. I just never know. You know what I mean? Just one time I have that shot and boom, I'm off and running and I don't know what's going to happen. And it's usually nothing ever good. You know what I mean? It's never good. So I'll get into kind of what happened. You know, I was in this heavy metal band for like 6 years, and we were traveling all over the place. You know, we were playing everywhere, and we were constantly drinking and all like that. We rehearsed like six nights a week. I had roadies that were just like holding the pipe to my mouth while I was playing, you know, and I always had beers piled up on the drum riser right here. And, you know, that was six nights a week. And then we had like a tech guy who was the cocaine guy. He would come out and give us bumps. And this was every night, man. And I had a good job, though. I don't know how I had a good job. It was just because I was younger and my body could still function, you know. And, you know, I was working for this company called WorldCom that was in telecommunications. And we had the biggest bankruptcy at the time, you know. And I had, as a young man in my, like, early 30s, you know, late 20s, early 30s, I had, like, a lot of stock options. And I had a lot of money in 401k and all that and stock options. And when they went bankrupt, I lost all that money. You know, I lost all that money. So I had this big resentment, this huge resentment against my company, you know. And I thought, you know, I took care of fiber optic networks on the coast of Central California. So I was always along all the beaches on Santa Barbara, always all along. Glenn knows. And I started going to these beaches all the time. I was like, they owe me. I'm not working. I'm just gonna run and get whatever work I can get done real quick, and I'd head to the beach in my company truck. And I'd park it right off the freeway, right there. Everyone be driving by seeing my Kevin's truck. There's Kevin's truck. They called me up, hey man, I seen your truck at the beach. All the other guys from AT&T and Sprint and the WorldCom turned into MCI and turned into Verizon, and that's who I was working for. And I had this big white truck with no company logos because I was a supervisor. I was the boss, you know. And I would just go hang out at this beach every day. As soon as I got, I'd do a couple hours work. If I wasn't at the beach, I had me and my guys were at a bar. We're at a bar, and we thought we're incognito because they'll never catch us. No one's going to pull us over in these trucks. You know what I mean? We're totally incognito, you know? And I did that for years. And then after a while, people started saying, man, what are you doing down there? Why are you always down there? Why are you there every day? You know, and I was isolating and I was drinking. And, you know, I found out there was naked women down there, you know? So then I started hanging out on the beach every day, and I got my little lawn chair, I got my cell phone, I'm on conference calls, I got the beautiful ocean and cliffs behind me, and the whole world is just behind me. I'm just isolating, you know, from everything. And I'm like, I'm never leaving this place. I'm never leaving this job. I got it good, man. You know, and then people started to question why they always saw my truck. Why was my truck always there? So there was a little frontage road close by that beach that I could kind of hide my truck in the trees. So I started. so I thought, you know, I always see cars over here. There's always like 5 to 10 cars here, but there's never anybody at the beach. But I would park my truck there, hide it in there. I'd have to traverse through this little forest, this little eucalyptus grove, which I called the gay forest. And then I'd have to jump down this little cliff and jam across the railroad tracks and scale down like this 30-foot cliff to get down to the beach, you know. So I kind of had an idea what all these guys were doing in the trees in there, but, well, you know, I was just like, hey, man, I don't care. It ain't bothering me, you know. I'd go and I'd get my little bag, what we call it, Patrick, the Vision for You backpack. And I have it all full, all my stuff, you know, and I jam through the gay forest, and like dudes like pop out behind trees like Robin Hood, like, hey there, boy. Wanna fool around, you know, and I'm like, I'm straight, you know. And I'm like bobbing and weaving trying to get through the forest. And then there's like this little drop off, and there's this branch going across. I used to grab onto it and swing down. And you had to be careful, because if you came out of the gate forest too fast, you'd fly right out on the railroad tracks, and you'd get hit by a train. So I got it down before I could stop, get across, and they never left the forest. Those guys were always there, you know. But so once I got down on the beach, I was home free, you know. Then I could get into my Vision for You bag and dig into my anti-spiritual kit. Beer, beach towel, binoculars. You gotta have binoculars because, you know, whale watching and stuff, you know. And whiskey shooter, Vicodin. And I'll leave the last one out. And that's what I was doing, man. I would just get down there and I would just get loaded, man. I would just hang out down there every day. I never once thought that undercover cops were watching all the cars in that area and rangers, you know. One day I was coming back up the trail and I saw like two rangers in the gay forest, and then they hid in the trees, and I was like, am I seeing things, you know? I just kept walking up and they stopped me and they questioned me and they asked me something you never want to have law enforcement ask. You know, that I never wanted to have law enforcement ask me. It was, do you have a large yellow smiley face tattooed on your right butt cheek? Right then, right, my heart just dropped. I mean, I knew I was busted. It was up, you know. Long story short, they had undercover guys on the cliffs taking pictures, and and they sent pictures and stuff to my company. And that, hey, you got a guy that's going down here during the week, you know, laying sunbathing nude on the beach, and not, he's supposed to, I'm sure, is he supposed to be working during these hours or whatever, you know? And so I lost my job of 22 years, okay? So meanwhile, I haven't got to this part of the story, but I'm married and have two kids at the time, you know, two beautiful young kids. And I have everything, man. I have you know, back then, this was like 15 years ago, right? And I had like, I owned a home. I was making like 120 grand a year at that job. My wife was in nursing school. I had two beautiful young boys. And, you know, I love those boys more than anything in the world. And I wanted to give them the life that I didn't have. You know what I mean? But really, look at me. I'm living this double life. I mean, how much do I really love them? I mean, I do love them with all my heart. But then the alcohol and the drugs and the distorted thinking and my twisted, you know, my mind. Look what I was doing. You know what I mean? And I couldn't see that. I couldn't put two and two together. I couldn't figure that out. You know what I mean? I was like blind to it, you know, like the strange mental twist that the book talks about, you know. And so I lose my job, and I have to come home and tell my wife that I lost my job because I was busted on a nude beach, you know. And I can still to this day see her face, you know. She was just crying. We're in the garage, and she just slid down the washer and dryer onto the floor and just put her hands in her face and just cried. It was horrifying. It was horrible. I felt like this big, you know. And it was such a shameful, embarrassing, you know. It sucks that that's my story, because then I gotta tell it all the time. You know, that's why I hate doing this. But it's part of my story, you know. It's where alcohol took me, you know. I had, you know, honestly, you know, I was an alcoholic, I was a drug addict, and I had a sex addiction. I had all three of them, triple threat, or three-time loser, whatever you want to call it, you know. I was very sick. You know. And that just like broke me, man. That broke me. And the thing of it is, I wouldn't have gotten in trouble, but there were some other guys at my work that was doing the same thing, driving the same truck. And I called them on the radio, and I'm saying, hey man, the Rangers just told me don't be laying out down here, don't be coming in here, don't go back here ever again. They're like, okay, I won't. Well, my buddy went there the very next day, and they saw his truck. And when they saw his truck, they thought it was mine. So they sent all the pictures and called my work. And then they had an investigation. And that's how I lost my job. And I didn't bring him into it. I didn't tell on him or anything. I was just done. You know that feeling when you're just done? It's like, I'm done lying. I'm done living the double life. I'm done being a liar, cheat, and a thief. I'm like broken. I'm emotionally broken. I'm totally that immoral, incomprehensible demoralization. That was me, man. I felt that through my whole body, you know. And so I just said, yeah, you know, I was there. It was me, you know. And they said, all right, well, you'll probably just get a slap on the hand. Don't worry about it. And the funny thing is, my manager, he was my buddy. He was really cool, and he was like, KG, if at any time I wiggle my ear, that means you tell him you got a problem and you need treatment. So we're in there with the investigator, and he's doing all this different shit. I didn't know what to do, you know. And I never said I needed help, you know. But I could have said that, but I didn't, and it's what needed to happen. I needed to lose my job. I was a horrible employee. I mean, look what I was doing. That's what needed to happen. That's what God reached down and smacked me upside the head and slapped me into reality, you know. That's what I needed. God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. And you think I would have stopped drinking, right? No. I went on to drink like another 2 years. And I went to work for Sprint immediately after that. Well, Sprint had GPS trackers on their trucks, so they always knew where the guys were. So I was pretty safe, you know. I could just Just drive right by there, and I was working on cell towers. I was going up these mountains and doing all this whole time, and just drinking a lot at home, after work, and it just got to where I just couldn't control it anymore. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. I had whiskey bottles hidden all over my house in my garage. And, you know, I didn't want my wife or my kids to know how much I was drinking. I'd get up at 6 a.m. and pound a Budweiser, you know, open the fridge, make sure no one's looking, you know. And I can remember those times, you know, coming home. My wife got to a point where she would keep one of these big, tall beer steins in the freezer so it's always cold. And she would fill that up with two beers and then hand it to me as soon as I walked in the door. I think about that now, thinking about what an a-hole I must have been to live with. You know what I mean? That she would go to that length to like, hey, man, at least if he's drunk, or at least if he's got a buzz on, he's not going to be a jerk. You know? And, you know, I just got to the point, where I wound up on my garage floor with a bottle of whiskey in one hand and a gun in the other. It's just time for me to die. I mean, I'd just be better off. I'm an embarrassment to my family, to my wife, to my kids. And it was just the worst feeling in the world. I just thought the best way out was just to kill myself. And that's really the way I felt. I just wanted to die, you know. And that cousin that was a cocaine dealer that I moved in with, he had 6 years of sobriety at the time when this was all happening to me. And, you know, he got on the phone. I remember him getting on the phone with me and saying, how much whiskey's left in that bottle? You know, and I just told him just a little bit. He's just like, pound that bottle, and you never have to drink again. You never have to drink and use again. And you could change your whole life, bro. You don't have to live like this, man. And, I did, and I still drank for a couple more days. But he was on me. He was one of these guys that he just wouldn't take no for an answer, you know. And he goes, you know, you need help. You need help, bro. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm looking in this, like, outpatient program. He's like, no, you need to go to treatment. And he kept, you know, he stated he would not take no for an answer, and he was not going to let me get out of it. I was trying every possible way to get out of it, because as sick as I was and all the crap I was doing, I still thought I had a plan. I still thought I could figure this out. You know what I mean? And he just wouldn't take no for an answer. He wasn't having it. And he's all, just please, just let me call. Let me make some calls. Let me try to find a treatment center for you. You know? And he made calls, and he called this one place. It was called the Bridge to Recovery. And they are a big treatment center. It's been around like 50 or 60 years, and they're in Kentucky. And he called him and was talking to him and saying, yeah, he's got multiple issues. He needs help. He had childhood trauma he's never dealt with. All this stuff, he's listening off to him. And she goes, well, if you could get him on a plane and get him here by tomorrow morning, we're starting a new group. We've got a whole new group of people, and we can fit him in. Do you know where Santa Barbara is? And he's like, yeah, it's like, that's where we are. You know, it's in our backyard, you know. And they had a new startup treatment at the Jane Fonda Ranch up in the mountains of Santa Barbara, you know. And previously, my father, who I never met, who left my... You know, I didn't get into all this, but he left my real mom when I was two and went and married another woman and raised her three kids that she had. He had passed away, and he left me $7,000. And this was like one of those $20,000 treatment centers. And they let me pay him just that $7,000 to go there for 30 days. And they never asked for any more than that money, you know. And it was just God, over and over and over, you know, helping me. And see, I thought God, you know, I believed in God. I believed in God. Through the end of this, I was going to church. Through the end of this, I was playing on the worship team at church. You know, I still do today. But I was sick, man. I believe God. I love God, but I thought God didn't believe in me. I thought God gave up on me a long time ago. Like, I'm too dirty. I'm too broke. You know what I mean? But he was there, and he was looking out for me, you know, doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And all those things just kept lining up and lining up and lining up, you know. And I went to that treatment center, man, and that's my sobriety day. I never went out after that, you know. I stayed sober. And they helped me out with things in there that, man, I mean, we did some crazy stuff in there. It was a trippy place. I mean, they had us carry little stuffed animals around, so that was like our inner child and stuff, you know. But I was like, I was willing to do whatever. You know what I mean? You tell me what to do, I'll do it. I don't care, because I'm going to die otherwise. That's the attitude I had, you know, and that also is a blessing from God, that willingness, you know, because I know a lot of guys that don't have that, and it kills them. It straight kills them. That's no joke. I've walked over a lot of bodies in the last 12 years. And so this treatment center, they did all kinds of crazy stuff, man. I was like, I did a fist step on a group level, you know, in a group. They had us beat these big old pads they had. These pads they put their knees and have handles on us and just beat it with a baseball bat and scream and let our anger out. They did all kinds of stuff, but it was exactly what I needed. You know, it was exactly what I needed, and to let go of that guilt and that shame, and they had some weird thing where we were like giving our shame back to the people like who molested us when we were children, you know, because it's their shame, it's not ours, and we did all kinds of this cool therapy, and man, it helped me. And then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they asked me, you know, in there, what's your plan? You got a plan when you get out? You know, I'm like, yeah, I'll probably go, you know, like a couple meetings a week, you know. I'll be fine, you know. And they're kind of like, no, I don't think so. I think you need to go more than that, you know. And I got out and I came here, you know, and I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw something, and I saw hope. I saw hope in these rooms. I saw people that are happy, you know what I mean? Just like, you know, you look around this room right now, there's miracles everywhere. If you just think about where all of us were at one point in our life compared to where we are now, it's a freaking miracle, you know what I mean? And there's miracles in this room everywhere. And I saw people laughing and smiling and hugging each other, and they were genuinely happy, you know? And it blew me away. And then I saw all these dudes that... They were like kind of cool, you know, and they sat at this one table at the Lion's Den, you know, Michael J, Luke, Joe K, Jason B, my old sponsor who moved away, and I wanted what they had. I wanted what they had. When they talked, when they shared in meetings, I listened to them, and I was like, wow, I hope someday I could sound like that. That would be really cool if I could talk like that, you know, or feel. Those guys seem like confident in themselves, and, you know, they don't have, it doesn't seem like they have a real low self-esteem, you know, they you know. And so I got a sponsor, you know, and, you know, like Jason would always tell me, you know, he goes, hey, man, you want what we got, do what we do as we do, you know. You need to get into action, you know. You know, you got the, he's always telling me, you got the talking part down, Golden. You know? Now let's walk the walk, not just talk the talk. You know, and that's what I've seen here. If you're new or newer and you're searching for the secret elixir or the magic, you know, what's that one thing that I'm missing? Why can't I stay sober? What do I have to do? You know? I don't get it. You're trying to figure it out. There is no answer. There is no easy answer. If I could sum it up in one word, I don't think I can, but if I could, I would probably take two words. I would say God and action are probably two of the biggest things I would say, you know. You know, but we could elaborate on that into willingness, acceptance, you know what I mean? All these things, service. You know, and that's what they told me when I got here. Man, you need to get into service. You need to take service commitments. You need to go to a meeting every day. Every day? You want me to go to a freaking meeting every day? That's insane. But I did it. I did it. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I took service commitments. I did a bunch of stuff that made me feel uncomfortable, that, you know, I didn't like want to do or like to do, like this, like I still do today, you know. I remember my sponsor telling me, you better buy a suit, Golden, because you're going to be attending a lot of funerals. Well, what? That's kind of crazy, you know. Why would you say that? And, you know, but it's been true. It's been true. It's been true, man, because this disease is out to kill us. And I don't know how many people, how many guys we've seen just like drink themselves to death. Just alcohol. You know, and then how many others that thought that they got some sobriety and thought they could do this. And if they were like me, as soon as you get alcohol or hard alcohol in you, you're looking for cocaine or you're looking for whatever. And now it's fentanyl and just boom, dead. Boom, dead. You know, this disease wants to kill us. And we always hear people say, you know, oh, my disease is out in the parking lot doing burpees, you know. So I better be doing burpees in here, because if I don't, that's going to kick my butt. And I know that to be true. And I'm not just up here womp. I'm up here just sharing what I've seen in the last 12 years. And that's what I've seen, man. That's exactly what I've seen. So I got busy, man. I started taking commitments. I started getting secretary in two meetings and having a cleanup commitment at another meeting. I had to put the amount of energy into my recovery, the same amount of energy I was putting into making sure I could get to that beach and drink whiskey every day or go see the dope man or whatever it is you're doing, you know. I had to put that same amount of energy into recovery, and recovery had to become the most focal point, you know, the most important thing in my life, you know. And my kids are the most important things in my life, but if I didn't have recovery, I wouldn't have my kids. I would have ruined that relationship. I would have ruined all that, you know. I remember when I got 5 years of sobriety, my sponsor goes, hey, man, get ready. Life's about to get real. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, 5 years, this is going to get real, bro. And at 5 years of sobriety, my you know, I got a divorce. My wife and I got a divorce. And what else did I do? I went nuts. I went, bought a Harley Davidson, I joined an MC, and I started dating a newcomer. 5 years of sobriety. Pretty freaking stupid. Huh? And I learned, and I remember my sponsor was like, dude, I won't be friends with people that do that. He goes, what are you doing? You know, oh, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. Yeah, buts belong in the forest, dude. I'm different. This is different. No, it's not different. You're stupid. Knock it off, you know. And that turned into a complete nightmare, of course, like it always does, you know. And but the divorce, I was 5 years sober, and you know, I snapped out of that. I did what he suggested, and I broke that off. And you know, that was all not fun, but, you know, I was able to maintain a relationship with my ex-wife, and we have a good relationship today. And me and Brooksy, she just moved to Montana, and me and Brooksy were at her house helping her move. Me and my girlfriend Brooksy were there helping her move. And when we got divorced, my son moved in with her, and he was like 17 at the time, and we talked. I think it's best if you be with mom, because I don't want her to be alone, you know, living there. And you know, all the relationship with my kids and my family, and that was because of you guys, of going to good sponsorship and other men in the program, how to walk through a divorce in sobriety, you know. And I never talked bad about her. And Brooksy knows that. And she'll never talk bad about her. And my ex-wife will never talk bad about Brooksy. And I would never badmouth my ex-wife in front of my kids, you know. The fact that all that was my fault anyway, you know what I mean? I just have a living amends towards that woman, to all the stuff that I did to her, you know. So I have to treat her with respect. And she's family, and she's always going to be family. You know, and I was able to walk through that with no... I mean, we had a big house in Fox and Wood. You know, we sold that house, and we both bought little houses in Old Orchid. We were like two blocks away from each other. And she let me live at her house while my house was closing. And then I moved over to my house, you know, and then they just moved off to Montana, you know, and my kids, I was there because of becoming sobriety. My kids were at a young age, you know, I didn't ruin their lives. You know, that could have went south, man. That could have went so bad, you know, and I have the greatest relationship with my kids. My oldest son is working on his master's degree at Portland University right now. My youngest son, he's flying planes at like 16 years old. You know, he's got his pilot's license. He's a crane operator and he's got his commercial driver's license and he's in Bozeman, Montana. So he could go to college there because they have a commercial flight school there. And he moved there to get residency for a year and go to college there. You know, these are gifts of the program. Right? I mean, they're good kids. They're probably going to succeed anyway. But boy, I could have really messed up their lives if I kept going and doing what I was doing. And I'm not proud of that. And I don't stand up here and share that to you know, I'm embarrassed and ashamed of what I did, but I had to work through that. And then the big book, it tells us we will not wish to close the door on our past, right? We will not regret our past nor wish to close the door on it. You know, and I didn't understand that, you know, when I first got here. I was like, what do you mean, man? I want to forget all that stuff. I don't even want to look at that stuff, man, what I was doing. And then I learned, you know, I know why now. It's because I could share it with the new guy. I could help the new guy. I could pass it on to the new guy. You know, I could help him. I could relate. Yeah, I've been there, bro. You're ashamed because you did that? Well, listen to this. You know what I mean? I was doing this A, B, and C, bro. You know, I was a sick, sick man. But I'm not. That's not me anymore. You know, that's not me anymore. I have a peace inside of me today. You know, we all have our struggles. Life's hard. Life's going to continue to be hard with or without alcohol, right? But I have a peace and serenity inside of me today that I did not know existed. I didn't know it existed until I came to the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know you could feel like this without alcohol. I didn't know you could barbecue without alcohol. I didn't know you could dance without alcohol. You know what I mean? I didn't know you could fish without alcohol. You know, all those redneck things I like to do, you know? I could live life so much better without alcohol. You know? Nothing really good ever happens in a blackout, right? You know? And I'm not drinking myself to death. I'm not embarrassing my family. I'm not getting arrested, you know? And I get to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous today that are just really cool. I was at 4 years of sobriety. I was I chaired the convention here. You know, I've had all kinds of really cool come in. I ran a speaker meeting for like 3 years. And now I'm really involved in H&I. And I go into the North Branch jail. Every Tuesday night, I go to jail. Sal goes with me. I never got busted, never got arrested, but I go to jail every Tuesday now. You know, I should have been arrested a lot of times, but I never got caught. You know, but I get to do that today. I get to bring the message to these guys that are locked up, you know, and get to share this message of recovery with them. And it's amazing, man. I get to see some guys come out and they call me. Hey, will you be my sponsor? You know, and then they disappear. But, you know, I try. You know, all we do is plant. We just plant the seeds. You know, I'm not in the results business. I'm in the action business, right? I'm in the action business. I got to, like Bob F., you're Nate's old sponsor. You say like a duck floating across the water. He looks like he's going real smooth, but underneath his feet are just moving. You know, and that's the kind of guy I aspire to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to be of action. I want to be of service. You know, they say 10% of the people do 90% of the work. What are you going to be? What do you want to be? Do you want to go sit in a meeting and just wait to be fed? Are you going to still be a taker or you want to be a giver? You know, what's it going to be? You know what I mean? And I found that, you know, being a giver, being of service, doing, you know, taking the actions, being willing to be uncomfortable, being willing to do the things that we need to do in here that's suggested of us. You know, that is what keeps me sober. That. And first, God, of course. Can't leave that out. But having this love in God in my life and doing this deal, it's just been the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, you know? It has. And everybody here can have that. And some of you already got it and you're probably happy. And if you're new, you don't have to live like that anymore, man. I'm here to tell you, you do not have to live like that anymore. You can change your life. It's not too late. I don't care how old you are. So, you know, I think that's enough out of me. Thank you, Patty, for asking me to speak. And thank you, guys.
All right, let's give Kevin one more round of applause.